Claudia Windle was sorting out her life when circumstances intervened. She was working as a nurse and as a priest, and she'd spent some time searching out her own Lakota native roots. And that's when her friend Verna called and asked if she wouldn't mind helping transport the body of a young man who died in Chicago and needed to be taken back home.
We got to talking about how difficult it is for our people to be buried, to find respect, to get bodies back to their homeland where they might be buried. And Verna very clearly turned to me and said, okay, you know, you recognize the problem, Claudia. Now you must do something about it.
Claudia did. She set up a low-cost service for taking the dead back home. And when she decided that wasn't enough, she was trained as a mortician and opened her own funeral home. She now gives something back to people who are past the point of asking for help themselves. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
You've heard the cliche about the two certainties we face, death and taxes. Well, these days you might add the additional certainty that both continue to cost us more than they did before. Let's skip taxes altogether. The average funeral now costs about $6,000. Some people just can't pay that. Claudia Windle sees families every day that can't make those kinds of payments, so she's trying to run a low-cost funeral service in the Minneapolis area. Claudia says most of her clients are Native Americans, but not all of them. Even when she was getting started in the funeral business, she says she discovered a class system regarding the dead.
We had a fellow who was mixed blood, African American and Native American, and in his late 20s, and he had murdered a mother and her two children, and in another murder, a gentleman and his adult daughter, and then hanged himself in jail. And I talked to the funeral director, who was absolutely disgusted. He did not want this funeral. And it was to the point of, you go to the morgue, you get his body, you get him off the cot yourself. You embalm him, and if you have trouble, God forbid, because I'm not going to be there, and you take care of him. And then the family asked me to also officiate for the service, which I do a goodly number of the services besides. And, you know, I was faced with the, what do you do with, you've got someone there kind of filleted literally from autopsy, and you're looking at them knowing that they have murdered five people, and yet you also know that they're a human being. And I couldn't have that attitude, you know. I mean, I certainly don't condone murder. That's a horrible thing. But I couldn't not take care of this person because of what he had done, because the person was not there. And it created an interesting time of thought and prayer and meditation in both in the preparation room and in preparing a homily for the funeral, you know, knowing that you have to acknowledge both parts of the person and their behaviors. It turned out okay, but the attitude of the director was extraordinarily telling as to who folks want to care for and who they don't. And I just think that, you know, we have licenses through the state of Minnesota to take care of people, and the whole socioeconomic piece really shouldn't count.
Claudia Windle says her desire to help people has been with her since she was a little girl in Catholic school, listening to her lessons and dreaming of being a priest.
Often the pastor of the parish would come in and say, so how many of you want to be priests when you grow up? And all the boys' hands would shoot up, as well as mine. And he'd kind of come over and pat me on the head and say, no, dear, girls can't be priests. You'll have to be a sister. I thought, well, I don't know. Okay, I'll consider this. And so by the time I was in high school, probably by my sophomore year, I had pretty well decided that I was going to become a sister.
What did your parents think about that?
I waited as long as I could to tell them. They didn't mind it. I can't say that they, you know, jumped up and down with great enthusiasm, but I learned recently from my mother that the day that they dropped me off at Mount St. Francis in Dubuque, my dad cried all the way home.
Claudia Windle was 17 when she joined the convent. Shortly after, she went to nursing school. She says that even at that young age, she liked caring for people in spiritual and physical ways at the most difficult times in their lives. Once in the hospital, she was caring for a young man on her overnight shift. He was critically ill.
And I went to see him. We prayed together. And he said, I really want the last rites. I feel that this life of mine is very short. Well, I had to call a priest.
Was it easy for you to get a priest?
No, he had a couple of, I called a couple of priests, and he did not belong to their parish. And so I had to call around a bit. It wasn't awful, but it was an interruption in what this young man and I had had together, as he had shared so much of his personal story and his feelings about dying.
So this guy's in his hospital bed, and he's near death, and you're going off to find a phone to find a priest.
Mm-hmm.
So where did you finally find a priest on that night? How did you do it?
I just called a couple of rectories and woke up a number of clergy, and finally one priest just said, when, where, how, and why, and he appeared probably 15 minutes later.
This young man, were you there with him when he died?
No, I was not. He died in the morning after my shift had ended.
This experience, and others like it, got Claudia Windle thinking that she still wanted to be that priest. So she left the Catholic Church and became an Episcopal priest, all the while continuing her work as a nurse. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Almost by chance, Claudia discovered that she had Native ancestors, that she's part Lakota. She started to make connections within the Native American community, and that led to an unusual request.
It was an elder from one of our reservations, and when she called me, we had not known each other very well, and I was surprised that the priest who referred her to me had some idea that I would know what to do with the body, because I had not done any of that work.
What did she ask? What did she want from you?
She wanted to know how she could get her cousin's body back from Chicago when the funeral home wanted $2,800 to bring him home.
Huh.
And I remembered something that an Episcopal priest in the church that I joined when I had made this big conversion to the Episcopal Church, and he said, you know, the next of kin has the right to the body. So I said, well, Verna, you're the next of kin, aren't you? She said, yeah. I said, well, then we've got a right to rent a van and go to Chicago and pick him up. I'll go with you. You will? And I said, sure, why not? Let me call the funeral home. And I called the funeral home and explained it, and the funeral director said, sure, no problem. And we went down, rented a van, went to Chicago.
Who was in the van with you?
Just Verna and myself. And we spent the night in Chicago, picked the body up the next morning.
Did they have the body in a coffin at that point?
They wanted to put him in one of the county caskets, and Verna didn't necessarily want him in one.
What's a county casket?
Oh, the county caskets, they're the ones that are paid for by the county when they fund us. And they're cardboard covered by a gray cloth.
Right.
But we got a metal casket for him, but we needed to go and have cash for the funeral director. So that meant running around to banks and Verna having to verify who she was and get money. And
tell me about the drive back from Chicago.
Well, Verna had gone through her cousin's belongings and had all of his Ojibwe singer tapes, which I said, you know, you're going to drive me nuts on this trip, being Lakota as I am. And she said, that's okay. You know, my cousin would want this music. And I said, you're the elder, that's fine. You know, it's only 8 hours. And coming back, we got to talking about how difficult it is for our people to be buried, to find respect, to get bodies back to their homeland where they might be buried. And Verna very clearly turned to me and said, okay, you know, you recognize the problem, Claudia. Now you must do something about it. And I said, oh, all right, sure.
What was she
and
asking?
I didn't have a clue. Well, at this point, she was asking that I find a way to help find a solution to the problem of transportation. And the only solution I could come up with was that I was going to need to do some transporting of remains. And I was pretty sure that I could do that without too much difficulty.
Before long, Claudia Windle was helping other Native Americans get their loved ones back from the cities to their country homes. And it wasn't a service exclusively for Natives. She had a friend, Ethel, who knew a Cuban refugee who'd died. And the women were taking this man's body, his name was Juan, they were taking his body to Eagle Butte for burial. It was a long drive.
Indian humor is very interesting, but, you know, we'd get out of the car to get lunch, and she'd knock on the lid of the casket. She'd say, Juan, we're going in. What do you want? You know? So when we pull up to Eagle Butte, she was staying with some family friends and thought maybe I would like to stay at the little motel there. And Juan was staying in the car outside the motel. And she once again, she knocks on the lid of his casket and she goes, hey, Juan, anybody who tries to bother you, honk twice. And I said, anybody honks twice and I'm out of here. I'll leave the keys. I wasn't that comfortable then.
Claudia Windle is a lot more comfortable with the business of death now. She'll still transport a body back to the Dakotas if someone asks. She's still an Episcopal priest, so she'll do the service as well and add in a little sweetgrass or tobacco if that's appropriate. But she's gone one significant step further. Claudia Windle also went to mortuary science school in order to start her own funeral home. And I'll talk more with her about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. You can pay anything you want for a funeral. The average price is about $6,000. Claudia Windle is trying to run a funeral home in Minneapolis that will offer significant savings to those who don't have that kind of money, and she says she can do it for less than half that amount, under $3,000. Claudia says there's been some grumbling from other funeral homes, but not much because she's not really competing with them at that level. She runs her own small funeral home serving mainly Native Americans. It all began when she helped a friend transport a body from Chicago. That led to years of work helping other Native Americans get their loved ones from distant cities back to the reservation for burial. But the more Claudia learned about the funeral business, the more she realized that the transportation of a body is only a small part of the cost.
You know, once you begin to explore an area, how things just grow and grow and grow. And I had started to work with a local funeral director. And this was a thought that our Department of Health had, that maybe he would like to take care of some of the Native folks that I knew. He was just opening a funeral home, and that was fine, except I learned that he didn't really much like Native Americans, and he didn't give us any breaks when it came to prices. And that's when it became evident that I needed to do something else. And he said, go to mortuary science school.
Well, that wasn't exactly what Claudia Windle had in mind. She already had two jobs. She was a nurse and an Episcopal priest.
I thought I was nuts, and it actually started by my going to the mortuary science school and the director showing me a video on embalming. And I emerged from this room 45 minutes later, totally shell-shocked, and he said, so, do we sign you up now? And I said, I wouldn't do that to my worst enemy. You gotta be nuts. And he said, fine, that's probably 6 months before you make the conversion. We'll see you back. And it was about that time, and it continued to bother me that without having an Indian funeral director who was willing to go the extra mile for our people, nothing was going to change. And I was already that close, and I could do the program in a year because of my background. So I just said, let's go for it. Well, and so I did.
Having been kind of put off initially by the video, how did you find it within yourself to go back in and actually begin embalming dead bodies?
Well, I just, when I realized that it looks worse than it really is, I guess I realized, too, that there are ways to do just about anything to anyone with respect. And definitely someone who is deceased feels no pain, so what looked to be painful is not painful to the people I serve. And it's a process that, because we've become so sanitized in America, that I was going to need to learn how to do that. So I did.
And what was your own plan? Were you thinking that if you could do this and become good at it, that you would be able to offer some kind of almost full-range funeral service to people who perhaps couldn't afford the funeral home fees?
Well, that was it. And then as I came through my internship and worked with various funeral homes, you know, I'd ask, well, if we have a native death, can I take care of them? Oh, sure, at their prices.
Oh, okay. So nobody was going to get a break on price.
No, and they were not going to, nobody was going to hire me and let me do that in their funeral home. And so that led me to buy a building and convert a storefront into a funeral home.
Claudia Windles had more than her share of trouble getting established, but she's now able to arrange a funeral the way she thinks it should be done. Claudia told me about the very first death she handled, that of a young woman.
She was a very, very large woman. She died in another town, and I drove down to Rochester to pick her up. And after I had embalmed her, I had talked to the family, and I said, you know, when you bring me the clothing, I want you to know that you're welcome to dress your sister with me. Really? Yeah, we'd like to do that. And so I think there were four of us, and we got her all dressed, and they helped me get her in the casket. Like, she was very large, and they wanted to help with that. And then the one brother stayed on while I was applying cosmetics, and I had taken the back of my hand and rubbed the cosmetics a bit on her cheek to get a little off, actually, and make it smoother. And her brother said to me, is that how you do it? And I said, well, that's how I do it. And I looked over, and he was doing the same thing on the other cheek. Huh. And he felt so good that he had been able to do something for his sister.
I've talked with family members who take part in that kind of ritual, and in almost every case they say, it's so important to do this. It means so much to us. And yet we seem to live these days, Claudia, in a society where we're so far separated from death. Someone in the family dies, and then someone comes and takes the body away. We never see it again. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, I do indeed. Now, I had this past week, and immediately when you and I are finished, I'm burying a 25-week-old baby, miscarried. And mom is very young, has another young one at home. And she and a good friend of hers and a cousin of hers came over to the funeral home yesterday. And they did a ritual washing of this little baby's hair and washed her body. And you can't really embalm a baby that small, so they usually are kind of soaked in embalming fluid. It's not a pleasant smell. And they kind of washed all that away. And they had a little Q-tip between her fingers. And, oh, my goodness, they washed every bit of her body. And then they went out to do a couple things, and I applied cosmetics. We dressed her together and placed her in the casket together. And, I mean, it was wonderful. What we did took 2.5 hours. If it had been me alone, I probably would have done it in about a half an hour. But you know what? Those were 2.5 hours that I would never take back, because what that did for those three women can't be duplicated any other way.
And where will this little baby be buried?
In a local cemetery here in Minneapolis.
And when you're dealing with people who are having trouble getting the money together to pay these kind of expenses, are there plots that are available in cases like this?
Most cemeteries have plots in a section of the cemetery called Baby Land or something very similar.
Yeah.
And those usually are at no charge. You know, even with this little baby for today, when I called the cemetery, I said, "Now, you are burying her in Baby Land." "Oh, yes, in the welfare section." And I said, "You have a welfare section in Baby Land?" "Oh, yes." And then I thought back, where have I buried babies at that cemetery? They're all along the roadway there, along the driveway. You know, most people don't want to be buried by all that. I was appalled, absolutely appalled.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. One recent death that Claudia Windle arranged was that of a middle-aged man. Claudia says she made 5 different visits to that family home to plan the funeral.
You know, the first time along, I very rarely take paperwork or anything. I just want them to meet me. I want to meet them. I want to hear about the deceased. I want to know what their needs are.
But why is that different from a regular funeral home?
Because most people who walk into a regular funeral home make their arrangements on the spot.
Right.
And I like to give folks a little time to think, and they generally will have made a decision before I leave, but that gives me time to get some samples, sometimes a sample of a casket, or look into what their financial possibilities are so we can see what merchandise we might look at. And this was a very, very young gal making arrangements for her father. In fact, she had just come home from the hospital having just delivered a baby. And I didn't want to just put her dad's cremated remains in an urn that they had selected by looking at a picture, unless that was really one that they liked and wanted. So when I went out and picked the urn up and took it back over to them, and they were thrilled with it.
What was it about that urn that caught their attention?
The company actually had a dream catcher, a very native symbol.
If I understand the way you're telling me this story, Claudia, you're going back out to this family's home each time?
Mm-hmm.
Is that normal?
Normal for me. I don't think it's normal for anyone else, but it's just the way I work.
Why does it make a difference? Why would you do it that way?
Because I think our people are more comfortable in their own homes. They can have whomever they want around. The kids don't bother them there as much as in a strange place. I don't know. I just think folks are more comfortable.
Would you mind, Claudia, if I asked you how much money that you would charge for that kind of a funeral, the service that you gave to that family?
Well, I didn't charge anything for all the running around. I think we did that whole thing for under $2,000.
That seems very inexpensive.
Yeah, you know, that was my general service fee, my basic service fee, which is the one you can't quibble about and are supposed to pay.
Yeah.
And the cremation and the urn, yeah, that wasn't too bad.
Is it a business that you can make money doing?
Well, let's just say so far it isn't. and hopefully someday it will be where there's at least enough money to sustain me. County funeral assistance is just totally disgusting in the little that they will pay.
Now, the county funeral assistance would be the people providing these kinds of services as a public service.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, I kind of need you to help me understand where you fit in the system, because I can see I can imagine that funeral directors, the people who run the big funeral homes, aren't too happy with you offering these specific services and not charging necessarily by their rate book.
Well, every funeral home is autonomous. Most funeral directors, to be perfectly honest, would rather not have welfare funerals because they don't bring anything in. And, you know, they feel used. You know, they've got a this, they've got a that, they're not making enough money, you know. And so, although they don't say it, I think they're probably just as happy that I take care of these families.
Claudia Wendell says she is incorporating more of her Native American identity into her services and her work in the funeral home.
I put tobacco on my cot. I keep tobacco in my prep room. And I have smudged using sweetgrass in the van before I pick the body up. I use a lot of Native imagery when I preach now. So it's kind of worked its way into almost every aspect of my life, but so subtly that sometimes I'm not even aware that that's happening.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Claudia Wendell is currently struggling to keep her business open. Tough times are hitting her as well. But she says she has no intention of giving up. She knows that what she's doing is the right thing.
It's been good for me because, you know, finding out that you have Native blood when you're an adult and not growing up on a reservation, you know, you really don't know how the rest of the world lives. And to watch our families and to watch them pull things together pretty well and to be caring individuals who would do anything in the world to have the things that they needed to bury someone the way society seems to think that you should. Because I'm so far in debt with the funeral home, I think I'm much more in tune to what some of our families feel. You know, I still have meals. There's a sizable amount of me. I mean, I haven't just vanished because I haven't eaten. But I do know, you know, I have much more of an understanding and a sensitivity. And I think it's so easy for many of the folks who own funeral homes, who have million-dollar buildings and they are not in debt and they can have what they want and they have $20,000 funerals, they don't understand. They don't understand that rich or poor, we all have feelings and the needs need to be addressed before the money. And then we need to find out where we can compromise and come together and make things work.
So if you were to give me one image, one picture of you as a funeral director when you knew that you were doing exactly what you were meant to be doing, what would it be? What would that scene be?
Oh, Lordy, I don't know. It'd probably be heaven.
No, but would it be standing, you know, way out in the Dakotas at a gravesite? Would it be working in your own little funeral parlor? What would it be?
Yeah, it would be working in my own place, and it would be probably having more than one body there at the same time, and knowing that we had a full schedule of being able to take care of our folks and take care of their needs. You would definitely hear Lakota flute music.
You play that while you work?
I do. I did until the funeral home was broken into and the thieves took my stereo.
And now you have to sing yourself.
I do have to sing myself. That's right. My Lakota's not that good. But I do. I sing. I often pray.
Claudia Wendell runs Oyate Tawijoha, it's Way of the People Funeral Home. And you can find out more about her on our website at thestory.org. One note here. Claudia's story was told in a Minnesota newspaper, the Star Tribune. One of our listeners read the story and thought what an interesting guest she'd be for the story. Sent the tip along. Thanks for that. And if you know of the kind of story where a person is led to their profession through that same mix of fate and passion, let me know. These are compelling stories to hear. You can always get in touch with me through our website at thestory.org or call and leave a message on our telephone line, 1-888-966-9862. Or write me a letter. The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, 27517. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. We know all the variations on the political question of the hour. Will she or won't she? Can she or can't she? Should she or shouldn't she? I'm going to leave the breathless panting over the question of Hillary Clinton's future to the political analysts and the talking heads. It's not that I don't care. I do. But it doesn't do much for me or for you to have me take my place in this great long conga line of political speculation. What we can do here at The Story is uncover political realities through the personal experiences of people who've been there. Now, you may have heard me asking about your most powerful political memories, the first time you voted, or a political moment that changed your life in some way. And you may have heard a couple of weeks ago Tom Linden talking about a telephone call from a man who would become a politician, a call that changed his life.
And the first thing I hear is, "Hi, is this Tom Linden? I'm Ralph Nader." And I go, "Yeah, sure, Wayne." Wayne was a friend of mine. "Wayne, this isn't real funny. You don't sound like Ralph Nader." He goes, no, "I'm Ralph Nader. I met your father on an airplane, and he tells me that you're thinking of leaving medical school to come work for me. I don't think that's a good idea," he said.
And that call made a difference. Tom did not become one of Nader's raiders. He stayed in med school. Well, today's story comes from Frank Lynch in Tallahassee, Florida, and it starts back in 1970. Frank was 18 and just coming into his prime as a hippie.
A tall, skinny kid with a white man's afro, tight jeans, tie-dye shirt.
Now, is this a serious white man's afro, the kind you'd use a pick for?
I had a pick.
So how big was the hair?
I was interviewed on TV one time, and my hair took up the entire screen except for a little teeny part of my face.
So I'm going to guess you were kind of proud of your hair at that time.
Oh, yeah. That was your calling card back then.
Frank Lynch was a political science student at Florida Junior College at Jacksonville. Frank knew that he might be drafted to go to Vietnam, and he felt that it was wrong to be there. Well, he dabbled in some protests against the war, but things changed for him one Friday at a local park where he'd started hanging out.
Had a nice fountain and nice walkways, very clean. It just became a good place to hang out, to meet people, to get into great conversations. But it started drawing more and more people. Sometimes on a Friday or Saturday night, there would be 200 or 300 people there. One night, all of a sudden, all these police showed up, some uniformed, some not. And they would just look at us and say, "They really said this, up against the wall."
No kidding.
Or up against the car. And they frisked us and asked us how old we were. I had just turned 18. One of my buddies was 19, and me and Danny, they put in the back of the police car, and
did they say why they were taking you downtown?
No. You know, I kept asking, "What am I being arrested for?" It wasn't until they were getting my fingerprints and taking my picture that somebody said it for loitering. Loitering in a public park at 8:30 at night.
This sounds like a Bob Dylan song. That's
They called it Jacksonville's first drug bust. 137 people were arrested, and they found drugs on two of them.
Are you serious?
The rest of the charges were loitering, vagrancy, etc.
And you were one of the loiterers, were you?
I was a loiterer.
Did you have to spend a night in jail?
It was a few hours. And first they put me in a drunk tank. That wasn't too pleasant. And they came and got me and said, we're going to put you in with your friends. Then they put me in with all the other hippies. And I'm going, oh, right. And we started singing our songs. We shall overcome. And I remember there was even a biker who was had a piece of a knife in his stomach just laying on the floor. And then I was told that somebody had come to bond me out. My mother had come down, paid $100 to bond me out. She was none too happy about it.
And what exactly was she like when you saw her?
In tears. I had disappointed her. I had never been in this kind of trouble before. But I kept thinking, oh, what did I do wrong? And of course, my friend Danny, who was a little older and a little more experienced, said, we'll just get the American Civil Liberties Union on this. My mother didn't want to hear any of that. But the ACLU did represent us, and when we walked into the court, the judge dismissed the charges within minutes.
Were you ever able to square this with your mother? I mean, persuade her that you really were just hanging out in the park like an ordinary 18-year-old?
She was never too happy about it, and the less we talked about it, the better.
And what about you? I mean, did you look at this as some kind of badge of honor? I, too, have been arrested, or were you bugged by this?
On the one hand, yeah, there was, you know, that bit of pride, but it, the other side of it is getting busted at 8:30 at night in a public park, me? Man, if they can do this to me, think what they can do to everybody else.
So would you say, Frank, that it did play some role in making you...
Politicizing?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, sure.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. And this was a good time to feel that political call to action because a bill was moving through Congress at that time that would change the voting age from 21 down to 18.
As soon as I became eligible, I'd made my mother take me down to the Supervisor of Elections office. Because she told me she wasn't registered either. And I said, well, then we're going to go.
So the two of you registered together.
That's right.
That's kind of cool.
Well, she had never been really politically active or anything. She came from a time growing up where she thought Franklin Roosevelt had always been president. And she was a northerner. You know, she was somewhat progressive, always taught me to treat everybody the same and to look out for your fellow man, that sort of thing. But she was never really politically active herself. And she wasn't too crazy about my hair either.
What was that moment like, though, going to register with your mother?
I was proud. You know, it made you feel like you were actually a citizen.
I mean, it's an interesting point because my recollection of that time, Frank, is that there were a lot of people, particularly young people who were opposed to the war, who kind of looked at, you know, politics as establishment politics and, you know, didn't want that much to do with it.
I wanted to infiltrate the system. I wanted to change the system. And I suggested that we have a voter registration drive on campus. That had never been done before. But I didn't want a voter registration drive with a bunch of blue-haired old ladies. There was a generation gap at that time, and if there was a table with some little old ladies who looked like your grandmother, I don't think many of us would have wanted to saunter on by to see what they were selling or offering.
You thought the way of pulling in young people was to have other people doing that then?
Sure, and because it was our right. So I got a couple of like-minded people to go with me down to the Supervisor of Elections office. And we sat in his office and said, hey, we'd like to have a voter registration drive out on the FJC campus. But we want our own people to register, the students. And he said, well, as long as they're registered to vote and they have to be deputized by me to be registrars. And I said, well, I'd also like for 18-year-olds to be able to register other 18-year-olds to vote. And he kind of balked at that and said, well, I'm not sure we can do that. We looked up the law, and to be a registrar, you had to be a registered voter. Didn't say you had to be 21. So I said, okay, so as long as we get the people down here, you can deputize them. He said, yeah. So we left, and I went to a local disc jockey that I knew and recruited him to make some announcements for us that we were going to have a voter registration drive, and we were going to be using students to register other students, and that you could show up at the supervisor of elections office at a particular date and time and be deputized to be a voter registrar. We had over 100 people show up. And most of the people working in the supervisor of elections office were middle-aged ladies, and I've just never seen something quite like this.
Well, what did they see? Describe the scene for me, yeah.
A lot of long hairs, a lot of earth mothers, a lot of strange and weird people. And because I had sort of organized this thing a little to my chagrin, I also smelled just a whiff of marijuana smoke.
You mean in the office you could pick up the scent of pot?
Yeah.
And you're thinking to yourself what at this point, Frank?
Oh, no. Not now.
If I recall, it was also people would choose unorthodox moments to light up a joint, right?
Well, that was sort of a badge of honor to say that, hey, I smoked pot on the Capitol steps, man. Hey, I smoked pot on the courthouse steps. So doing something like that wasn't totally out of the norm. But it was because my name was out there and the supervisor of elections knew me better than anybody else. Of course, I was going, oh, I hope he didn't smell that.
Now, did you get all those people registered to be part of your voter drive?
Well, the supervisor was getting pretty upset at this point. He'd never had this many people, particularly young people, particularly loud people, in his office all at the same time. And he had to get up on a chair. His face was getting pretty red. And called everybody to order and had them raise their right hand and swear, do this oath. And that was it. Lasted about 10 minutes.
And so how did the registration drive go?
My particular campus, I believe we registered 497 people. Hey, man, come on over here. Let's get registered to vote. Registered to vote. Hey, why not? And because it was new, because the 18-year-old vote had just come in, sure, there was some excitement about it. We actually believed that, you know, if we could get enough people together at the same time, we could end the war. And I actually believed if we got enough young people registered and out to vote, we could get Richard Nixon out of office. Boy, was I wrong.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Well, back in the fall of 72, Frank Lynch watched George McGovern go down to Richard Nixon in almost every state. But Frank says even that didn't entirely douse his interest in politics. After all, that autumn of 72 was his first chance to vote.
You walked in, pulled the lever, a curtain closed behind you. Then you looked up at this array of names and you tried to find the name that you wanted. And there was a little lever, less than an inch, and you pulled the little lever down. You saw a little speck of color showing that you had pulled that candidate's name. Then you pulled the handle back when I pulled that lever back, and the curtain opened up behind me, and I said, wow, I voted. Cool.
My recollection is while there was a real uptick in the number of young people registered for the 1972 election, not all of them voted.
Oh, turnout was very poor. Turnout was very poor, and they tended to vote the way their parents voted.
Were you discouraged by that?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I was very disappointed by that, because I was a true believer. We were naive then, but it was a good naivety. We did feel that we could change things. We did believe in those things. We really felt that if you got enough people together at the same time, they had to end the war, didn't they? That if enough young people got together and said no more, then it had to happen. They had to listen to us. It wasn't until later I realized, yeah, they could ignore us.
This was your first time politically engaged, your first time mm-hmm. voting, and everything that you had been going towards got shut down. Nixon pretty well swept the country. I mean, was there a part of you that
49
said...
49 states, yes.
Yeah, was there a part of you that said, this system doesn't work. I don't want to be a part of this.
I still felt that we could change the system. I didn't see any other way.
Well, that was more than 35 years ago. I'm curious to know if your sense of engagement is still as strong as it was back then.
You know, I think it still is. I do things a little differently now, but I look at what's been happening in the primaries this past year, and with the number of young people registering and turning out to vote. And actually, voter registration is up all across the board. Young people, old people, white people, black people. I think it says something about our democracy. I've always felt that the more people who voted, the better off we would be. It's when you only have 40 or 50% voting that the bad guys can get in. But if we can reach 70, 80, 90%, we'll have much more of a sense of what the country really wants, what the country is really about.
So you're encouraged to see the level of engagement that we're watching in this particular election year?
Oh, I'm excited about it. I think a real change is on the horizon.
Careful now, 1972 all over again?
All three candidates are going to be a change, whichever one wins. Yes, I have my favorite.
Now that's a political answer.
But I do think that things are going to change for the better. And, hey, you know, you always have to hope. You always have to have something to believe in.
What is it you do for a living now, Frank?
I'm an insurance agent.
And if we were to flash back to that skinny little 18-year-old hanging out in the park in Jacksonville back in 1970 and tell him, guess what? When you grow up, you're going to be an insurance agent. What would he have said?
Never know how things are going to turn out.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me.
Frank Lynch volunteered his moment of political awakening. You know what I like about these stories is that they're not manufactured by the ad makers or bent by pollsters or spin artists. If you have a memory of the first time you voted or an instant of political engagement you want to talk about, do what Frank did. Go to our website, thestory.org. Just leave me a note there. Our crack team of producers will take care of the rest. Or you can leave me a message on our telephone line, 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. Lost my radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are nice. Oh, mercy, mercy me.
This story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.